evening, listeners, and thank you for tuning in to Pompey the Great and the Fall of the Roman Republic, Episode 1, The Rising Sun. Well, technically it's Episode 3, but we had two introductory episodes to get our listeners up to speed.
Yeah, this is a pretty meaty story, guys. There's a lot of foundation that we laid in the previous two episodes. We basically went over the agrarian reforms. We went over the Punic Wars.
The influx of slavery and wealth into the empire.
We went over the rise of Marius.
The acquisition of new provinces overseas.
The law courts that created a rift between these equites and the Senate. And the rise of political violence in the street.
Feminist Greek virtues, allegedly.
Allegedly. But today, we continue the story. In the last episode, we left you with the Senate passing this Lex Calicia Didia, which forbid the tacking measures of the of omnibus bills, and it guarded the Senate from this coalition of the equites and the plebs by doing that. And it also set an interval between when a law was proposed and when it was voted on. And this really ensured that the Senate had enough time to react to any legislation that was coming through. They didn't want any more of these last-minute huge bills that were just being taken directly to the people. They had had enough of that.
And I'm sure there's nothing they can possibly think of that would circumvent legislation.
Exactly. So you basically also have, in 95, the consuls carry another law, the Lex Licinia Muca, which establishes an additional court. So you have even more, an additional court being set to try any alien that claimed to be Rome. So you see a lot of this anti-Roman ally sentiment start to be amped up in Rome. And you start to see a huge rift between the Senate and the equites at the same time. An equestrian jury ends up condemning Rutilius Rufus, who is a legate of Scaevola, on charges of extorting one of the Roman provinces. Although it's completely obvious Rufus is a very moral, virtuous guy, we're told. He strongly believed in this hip Roman Stoic philosophy of the day, and he declined to defend himself, and he passively accepted his own exile. Basically you have this this huge rift between the equites, the Senate. You have this unruly mob of angry plebs, and you have this disgruntled array of allied people who had fought hard for Rome, but they're not getting any of the rewards that come with all these victories. And with all this different pressure, something's got to give.
Which brings us to our next political player on the scene. Excuse me. M. Livius Drusus, Tribune, 91 BC.
And this was...
Tory Democrat.
Yeah.
Drusus.
Well, yeah, we'll make the distinction. This is the Drusus that was the son of the previous Drusus that we talked about, who's the opponent of Caius Gracchus, who was just, if you remember, he was just giving everything away, all these empty promises. This was his son, and there's a lot of confusion about this guy. We don't really have time to really go into a lot of what he did, but, basically he was styling himself as a Gracchus brother, but ultimately he was aiming to restore the power to the Senate. So he was kind of like version 2.0 Marcus Livius Drusus, coming in.
Right.
He passed a corn and agrarian law to gain some popular support. Obvious that's just a general agrarian reformer staples, passing corn and agrarian laws. Everyone gets corn.
So so Drusus 2.0 had two objectives. One, strengthen the Senate, and two, enfranchise the Italians.
Exactly.
Disgruntled Italians.
And so when he passed these agrarian laws and this corn reform, this really worried the Allies because they were afraid of opening the Ager Publicus that had actually was being held de facto by the Allies, like we had talked about in the intro. But, he proposed to establish a rapport with the Allies by advocating for their enfranchisement. And this was going to relieve, he thought, the pressures from the urban plebs. The urban plebs didn't want to share, you know, their rights and their lands with the allies. So he ended up seeming very suspicious to both parties that he was trying to placate. And then he ended up additionally compounding his problems by he tried to end this rift that we talked about that was created between the Senate and the Equites. So he proposed, he even got involved in the courts. He proposed to share the courts between the two of them. Or maybe we also have sources that say that he proposed to double the numbers of the Senate by adding 300 Equites, and then restore the courts to this new Senate dominated, or to the new Senate dominated courts.
That would unite the two classes' interest, and the enfranchisement of the Italians is a little bit of a smokescreen, at least to how he probably portrayed it to the Senate, because a lot of these Italians that would become allies to Rome were really at a distance so far from Rome that they wouldn't be able to vote. And I think that the Senate probably entertained a possibility that if they were incorporated into the voting tribes, that they could be done so in a way that would be advantageous to the control the Senate had over the voting.
Exactly. And it would just be a Band-Aid over it. The Senate would really maintain control. Same with the courts. He wanted to try to do some number magic so that, you know, the Equites and the Senate shared control of the courts, but really the Senate would be in control. So he was kind of this Drusus 2.0, making promises that really amounted to nothing, hollow promises. So,
and his chances of success were small. I mean, what was in it for the majority of the knights?
Yeah, I mean, basically this just further embittered the knights, the Equites, because his law made all members of the courts and Equites and senators now also liable to prosecution for bribery, which, you know, that was basically the way you did business in Rome.
So Drusus thus put forward his ideas to find colonies.
Yeah, he also put forward ideas to found colonies. You know, this was another one of his measures to try to get out of this back and forth that he was doing. But he ended up continually alienating factions because he was trying to please everyone, so he couldn't please anyone. And basically, this turned the popular assembly was against him. You know, we even have his main opponent, Marcius Philippus, informing him of a plot that the Italians that were trying to kill him. We have a lot of people. You know, he ends up not even leaving his house because of all these different threats. And he ends up being murdered with a leather worker's knife in his basically his doorway. And so basically this...
So because of his relationship for the Allies, he's basically suspected of treason, and it doesn't help that in order to even bring these laws to a vote, he had to ignore the Caecilian Didian laws and probably resort to violence, good old violence in the state.
Right, and I think it's really important that you brought that up because, you know, Philippus, is the opponent of Drusus, invoked the Caecilian Didia law.
I said that wrong?
Lex Caecilia Didia. I'm not sure how we pronounce those, but we all know what we're talking about.
Yeah, so if anyone wants to write in, you know, we're not language scholars, but, you know, feel free to comment.
Basically, yeah. And so so he wanted to basically just make all of Drusus's legislation invalid because he was doing a lot of tacking. He was trying to placate everyone, and so he was wanting to invoke that Caecilia Didia law. So basically soon after you know, this happened, he was murdered, and then his political colleagues ended up becoming marginalized, and in 90 Tribune Hubridia disregarded the veto, passing a law that established a court of equestrians that would try anyone suspected of collusion with the Allies. So basically the equestrians were now pretty much establishing a court, a witch hunt court. And so this led to the beginning of a law in which the various Hubridia would basically, he himself later be condemned. He accuses Scaurus, that original guy that was condemning the corrupt officials in the Jugurthine Wars. He accuses him in a moment of fervor of condemning people, and he and Q Varius responds, Q Varius, a Spaniard, claims that M. Scaurus, Princeps Senatus, the first senator, stirred up the allies to revolt. M. Scaurus, Princeps Senatus, denies it. There are no witnesses. Which citizen is fitting for you to believe? And at that, Varius Huberta fled town, and I believe he was murdered.
And to add insult to injury, Drusus' death was never investigated, as far as we know, in any way. And this was pretty much the signal for the Italians to revolt.
Yeah, and we also had earlier revolts, in Fregelli that we talked about before, that Opimius had put down. So there was obvious signs of revolt going on. And there's also that the witch hunts that were starting in Rome, of people that were accused of collusion with the Allies. So it was all set up to as a powder keg in Italy at this time.
So 91 BC, Drusus is eliminated. The social war begins.
Exactly. And so you have this, the Senate, basically had various agents all around Italy to kind of monitor the action of the Allies, because they knew that there was fomentation going on. In one particular area in Picenum, and particularly in Asculum, the people supposedly were told that they thought they had been discovered planning their war against Rome, and they were they basically killed a visiting Roman praetor, and this they sent a group to Rome to protest their treatment, and the Senate refused to hear them until they made restitution for this murder, which they called the massacre at Asculum. Basically, what the Allies were complaining of, they were complaining about these corrupt magistrates that controlled these agrarian councils that were set up, that were basically ruling always in favor of the Romans. And we have to remember that at this time, the Romans were levying troops from their allies based on these bilateral contracts that were established.
And the contrast is even greater because, to put yourself, are you drinking coffee? put this in a more familiar context. You know, to a Roman supremacy was absolutely everything. Other citizens, people who were not Romans, really had no rights to life or liberty as far as a Roman was concerned. You know, you live in a society where you could put your family, your slaves to death if you're the father of a household. You know, so of course they don't give a damn about, you know, the other Italians, the other allies. They treat most other people with disregard because they're not Roman citizens, and it was just a common normal mentality for a Roman to be superior. If a senator goes overseas, he outranks every king of every land. He outranks the king of kings. You know, that's what it means to these people to be a Roman, is that Roman supremacy is domineering, and that's just the end of it.
Yeah, and so basically you had this envoy to Rome. The Senate wasn't hearing it. They were basically just itching for a war at this point. Neither side budged. And so the Samnites and the Highlanders and the Picenum spent the winter preparing for war. They knew which way the winds were blowing. So basically the Highlanders grew in number, and they started splitting off into two camps. To the north and south, we had the tribes of the Marsic, and in the south, we had the Samnites. The areas of Latium, which are south of Rome, and northern Campania. Campania is kind of the area around where modern-day Naples is. It includes important cities in there. It includes Nola and Capua. Those areas remained loyal to Rome during this upheaval. And Calabria, which is kind of, if you imagine Italy as a boot, it's kind of the heel. That's where Brundisium is. So basically you have all these allied forces beginning to muster in southern Campania, Licania, and Apulia. So basically in all, you had 8 tribes join on with these Highlanders and the Samnites. You had the Marsi, Picintes from Picenum, Pelinghi, sorry about my pronunciation here, Marucini, the Vestini, the Frettani, the Samnites, and the Hirupini, the Samnites and the Hirupini. They sought out to establish basically an independent state that lied in Peglini, surrounded by the mountains. So basically this is an area directly east of Rome, in an area, the city of Corfinium. So basically this was, they tried to set it up. They even had a senate, they had officers, they even began to mint coinage. Yeah, so they were really setting it up, and it really showed that they wanted to be a part of Rome.
You said their headquarters was where?
In Corfinium.
Which they renamed, get this, get the originality of this, Italia.
Exactly, and that was the name of the original inhabitants. That's what they called themselves, Italia.
Wow.
And so you have basically just to outline the area, different areas we're going to be talking about. You have Sicily, which is, if you think of Italy as a boot kicking a football, Sicily is the football. It's the big island down off the toe. Moving up, you have Bruttium. You have Calabria. We already talked about that as being the heel. Bruttium is the toe. You basically have Lucania, which is kind of the ankle area. You have Apulia, which is kind of the Achilles heel, I guess you could call it, of Rome. And then you have not Calabria, but Campania and Latium and Rome. It's basically the shin of the leg of the boot. Etruria is kind of the upper thigh. And then if you go between, if you go to the back, I guess you could call it the hamstring, is Picenum.
And the calf of the boot.
Yeah, the calf of the boot. And then above that, you have Umbria. And then you have above that, at the very top, you have Cisalpine Gaul. And between Cisalpine Gaul and Umbria, you have the Po Valley, which is mentioned quite often. And then if you kind of go in between Etruria and Picenum, you have Umbria, kind of north, modern-day Tuscany area, you know, slightly south of modern-day Tuscany. Those are basically the geographical locations. And we'll kind of get into some of the geography, you know, of the areas too as we go. Corfinium was actually chosen because of its very strategic location. It was surrounded by basically mountains, and it lied in the valley of the Peglini, which was one of the tribes that joined with the Romans. So basically war broke out, and there was the two main theaters, you know, as we talked about, the Marsic, sometimes this social war of the allies, the Marsic War. They're referred to many different ways, but in the north you have the Marsics, and then in the south you have the Samnites.
Wow.
So basically in the northern theater, in the northern areas, you had the consul Rutilius Lupus coming into play for the Romans. He was backed up by Marius and Pompey the Great's father, Pompeius Strabo, both as his legates. So it's interesting you have Marius coming back into the scene. It's really viewed as a critical time for Rome. Rome is basically pulling in all the superstars they can get. The allies have Palpadius Silo, or Silo, which was the commander of the Marsic forces. In the south, you had the consul Julius Caesar, not Julius Caesar, that we'll talk about later, who's opposed. Who? But yeah, exactly. And he actually had Sulla and T. Didius as his legates. And Didius is an interesting figure, too, but Sulla, I think, is the more important one here to realize. And so for the allies, you had Papius Mutilius as the commander of the Samnites.
And the rebels clearly lacked leadership at first. as the Roman generals were a part of the aristocracy. And eventually Rome was, you know, maybe jumping ahead here, eventually Rome was only able to win via concessions. And the war went on from, what, 91 to 89?
Sounds about right.
No, we should probably... yeah, started in the winter of 91 through...
Yeah, 89, I think. It varies because you even have, during the Roman Civil War, you still have pockets of the Samnites in the south that are coming into play. Oh, yeah. You know, so, I mean, we could say it stops and starts, but really, any time we choose is going to be arbitrary.
But for the most part, by the end of 90 BC, the Romans finally gave in. And the Lex Julia was passed, granting full citizenship to such allies that had not revolted or those who had immediately returned to their former allegiance. These concessions restored order in Etruria and Umbria, but war still raged in central Italy. In 89, the conflict continued, but the tide was turning for Rome. The success in battles were accompanied by two tribunes that year passing a law that all Italians would receive citizenship if they made their application known within 60 days. Meanwhile, Mithridates, King of Pontus, King of Kings, was taking advantage of the situation and decided to extend his power. In the elections of 88, Sulla was elected consul and was assigned command of the East. Marius had other plans. I move a little fast there?
No, I think it's good.
So King Mithridates, King of Pontus, that is such an amazing character to me. We could do a podcast on him one day. And if this podcast goes well, I will.
I think one of the things that we should really illustrate, though, about the social war is, you know, the main figures that emerged out of that, the main champions were Sulla. He basically had many, many victories during the social war. You had the return of Marius. Marius was back on the scene from his, you know, self-imposed exile or his ruined political machinations that caused him to have to go. He was back in, and then we have the rise of this sort of new man on the scene, which was Pompey the Great's father, Strabo,
who was elected consul in 89, probably because of his military record.
Right, he did celebrate a victory at Asculum. He celebrated with a triumph. He actually laid siege to Asculum. We even have records of Pompey being there when he granted Roman citizenship to 30 of the Spanish cavalry.
Pompey would have been probably 16 or 17 in the theater of war there. And
he'd have been very young, but he still would have been inside of Strabo's inner circle.
Oh, doubtless.
So we have basically these three main figures that are coming out. And basically, Sulla ends up coming out as the major figure. You know, we have Marius ends up having to, although he ends up doing a great job in the north, we're told he has to resign due to some ill health. And it's kind of at this point, it doesn't really say it, but, you know, later we'll get into Marius's mental state. We obviously start seeing some...
Not to mention he's, what, 69, 70 at the end of the social war?
Yeah, he's getting pretty close to 70. But he ends up, you know, he ends up having some pneumonia-type symptoms, and he ends up really starting to break down. His behavior starts changing. He becomes almost a different person than the Marius of the Jugurthine Wars and the Marius that was the savior of the Teutons and the Cimbri. You know, he really begins to change. But Sulla ends up emerging as the victorious man that really beat the Samnites into submission, or almost into submission, down in the south and southern Italy. Sulla is rewarded for his service in the social wars with the consulship of 88. You know, which they were all pretty much vying for. And Marius really becomes embittered with Sulla. And he becomes embittered...
And this goes back to him ending the war in Africa in one swoop.
Stealing his thunder. He stole Marius's thunder. And we even see that in the Tooth and the Kimbri War. Sulla actually transfers command from underneath Marius into the command of Catalyst, which they were defending against two different sides.
And this goes right down to Roman supremacy. You know, Sulla essentially offended Marius's dignity and authority. And that's just...
we're even told that he ends up having a signet ring cast. Sulla has a signet ring cast with him capturing Jugurtha on
it. And he's bowing down.
Yeah, and so he's going around town using this and flaunting the fact that he captured Marius's, 3 minutes of fame during that time. So basically, there's this huge rift. Marius is also displeased that Sulla divorced his wife and married the daughter of Metellus, his old enemy. So he kind of, Sulla doubles down on the offenses to Marius at that time. And also, now that Sulla is a consul, he's now on equal footing with Marius, which displeases him even more.
And the contrast between these two famous generals couldn't be more striking. As we mentioned in the last podcast, Marius is a humble man from Arpinum. He was a new man, though he was seven times elected consul. Sulla is a blue-blooded patrician, so there's a marked contrast between their breeding, if you will.
Exactly, and also, during this war, we saw Strabo come up, and he's kind of an interesting third party that we really don't see, I think, given enough credit. Really when we're told, hear about this, we hear about, Marius and Sulla, but, you have Strabo, he passed a law, the Lex Pompeia, which granted the Latin status to the Transpadines, essentially extending Roman citizenship to all the people south of the River Po. So he basically does this in an attempt to expand his clientelia and his influence all the way up beyond the Po.
And that's an amazing thing that I like about the Pompeys. And you're right about Strabo being underappreciated. During the end of the social wars and the rise of the civil wars in Rome, which would last several decades, he is absolutely a force to be reckoned with. And spoiler, he dies a little prematurely, but things could have gone so many different directions in history between Marius, Sulla, and Strabo.
And really, when we think about Strabo and the Pompeys,
they didn't have the ancestral esteem that Sulla and the Metelli had. So Strabo, in a lot of ways, was in the same class as Marius.
Strabo had to work his way up the ranks, but he ended up serving in Sardinia, and then he ended up serving in Sicily as governor of Sicily, and then he ended up purchasing a large amount of estate in Picenum.
Picenum,
and that's essentially why he was chosen to go there, because he owned so much of the territory, and we're told his negotiations with the tribes there were very relaxed, very formal. He was talking very matter-of-factly, almost like he was negotiating a deal on behalf of the Latins and the Romans.
So despite patrician or support from the nobility, Strabo remarkably was able to draw upon his allies that he made in Sicily and Gaul and in Picenum, his clients there, the people who were indebted to him. And we did explain clientelia in earlier podcast, but him and like his son, Pompey the Great, are both men who had to rely heavily on their connections with the people that they subjugated or helped or from their ancestral homeland of Picenum, because they did not have strong family connections that were esteemed by the oligarchy.
And it was kind of interesting to note that the Pompey family actually first achieved their office in 141 with Q. Pompeius. And Q. Pompeius actually played a really prominent part in the opposition to Tiberius Gracchus, who was that initial agrarian reformer after Laelius. But it's really obscure how Strabo was connected to the Pompeius family. We know the tribe must have been from Clustium, but they weren't really from the Picenum area. Nevertheless, Pompey owned Pompey owned extensive estates in Picenum, and this is really what led to their appointments to really besiege Asculum and really negotiate with them. And we have a lot of figures, you know, like Cicero. He served in Strabo's army.
Oh, yes.
When, he was against the Marci. And
he was parallel to Pompey. They were both born in 106 BC. And, you know, they both served under Strabo's command. And I'm sure they didn't realize, both these men, that their destinies are going to be so intertwined and linked as their career goes on. And that's kind of a neat thing to think about, though. Mm-hmm. I'm sure they knew each other, but you know, to think that they were good pals back in the day. Well, we'll get more into Cicero, but not a lot is known about Strabo.
Yeah, and that's really unfortunate, because he really was this third kind of power node that emerged out of this social war. And also another issue that was created during the social war is you had a lot of debitors and creditors, and these debitors and creditors began causing a lot of friction within the city. They basically, people made loans, and there were a lot of people taking money. With the influx, one of the big things with the influx of all these people is it was getting a lot harder to bribe individuals and control individuals, because they had more political power. And that was one of the main reasons that the Senate really opposed all these changes, is because it was getting way more expensive to amass political clout, because you're having to bribe more and more people. So basically the creditors were now placing interest on loans, and this was against an older law that forbade usury. And the debitors really stopped paying their loans because of the war and the silver problems, but that was really a pretext, because they just didn't want to pay the interest, you know. We have this guy named Acilio. He's put in charge of these matters, but he was not really able to persuade anyone, and he just ended up giving that matter to these courts. And we all know these courts now are really highly politicized, really embittered, and basically the lenders, who were angry that the law prohibiting usury was now being enacted, killed Acilio, and he was murdered in the middle of the day. He was wearing his ceremonial clothing. We were told he's performing a sacrifice, and the Senate basically offered a reward for any information about who murdered him. But Appian tells us that the moneylenders basically covered everything up. So we kind of see this element of financing entering into the politically charged courts.
So in all these aspects, all these political, economic crises that we're seeing are starting to climax in this period. And I have a quote here from Appian. As far as some of these military generals are concerned, you have men illegally conscripting armies, and the civil war really takes off. And Appian says, "For hitherto, the political murders and sedition at Rome had been intermittent domestic affairs on a relatively small scale. But from now on, the leaders of the factions began to assail each other with great armies according to the laws of war, and looked upon their country as the prize in the contest of arms."
It's heavy stuff. It's really crazy. And basically you have Drusus die, and then you have basically what Drusus wanted anyway come to pass. And so a lot of his colleagues started to enter into the political scene. In 88, you had Pompeius Rufus, who was a cousin of Strabo's, another one of these weird, odd Pompeians. From this kind of this obscure clan come in. And you also had another friend of Drusus, Sulpicius Rufus, elected as tribune. And what Sulpicius wanted to do is he really wanted to fairly distribute the newly enfranchised Italians into the tribes. Because I think what you were talking about earlier is what was happening is that they admitted these people, but they didn't distribute them properly into the tribe. So there's a bit of gerrymandering going on. They were admitted, but they were organized in such a way where their votes would be ineffective.
And this was the same tribune who Marius would utilize, because as we said earlier, he wasn't a great orator. He wasn't really a very, he's described as a clumsy politician. So this is the tribune you're talking about, who's also going to propose giving the Eastern Command against Mithridates to Marius and transferring the command from Sulla.
Right. Basically, he does this in an exchange. He kind of teams up with Marius to pass this new law of redistribution for the tribes.
My God, this would have been a very reasonable time for Marius to retire. We're going to see what he ends up doing with his reputation.
Right, and what's really interesting to me, and maybe you have some kind of perspective on this, is, we see Marius fall ill, during the social wars, and then you start to see his behavior change a little bit. And I don't know what occurred to him when he fell from power with the Saturninus affair, but it seems like to me things really went downhill for him mentally, and it almost seems like maybe he's being used by forces outside of his control. Because he's older, he may or may not have his mental faculties coming in and out. He may be ill, and I kind of wanted to know what your perspective is on that, because that's something that I'm just looking at.
I think it's definitely plausible. With Saturninus,
Saturninus,
yeah. He was a bit of a rogue. If Marius had revolutionary tendencies or had massive vengeance on his mind, he could have enacted him then. Instead he took the high ground and obeyed the state and quelled the insurrection and the upheaval of the tribune. And then he's markedly different during this period. And like I said, this would have been a fine time for him to retire. He was consul 6 times, one of the most famous commanders Rome had ever known, but he was close to 70 years old. But his jealousy would leave a blood red tarnish on his reputation forever.
Maybe now, but maybe later. I don't know. Maybe he's starting to go. Maybe he's not. That's all just our own speculation. When it comes in, you have Sulpicius teaming up with Marius. Basically, Marius wanted the command in the east, the Mithridate campaign that he was actually, I feel he was plotting with Saturninus for.
Marius?
You have Saturninus, that the Marius and Saturninus, I really feel like they were plotting for this. Because if you remember, Saturninus was actually insulting the legates, or was insulting the envoy from Mithridates. Saturninus was actually drawn up on charges for that, but he was rescued by an angry mob that came and rescued him from the courthouses. I think Marius is really angling for this, and I think one of that was that support for Antonius that Saturninus also drew up that law that gave consolidated all military power under a single control. Really laid the groundwork for having an extended consulship in the east. So I think Marius really had schemes of this, and I think when he saw Sulla win the consulship as a reward for the social war and come in, I think he was really viewing that as Sulla again coming in and stealing his prize. I really think that dynamic was there. So basically, they Marius teams up with Sulpicius,
who
basically proposes that all these new allies be properly distributed amongst the tribes. We are told that on the day of the vote, the old citizens and the new citizens, quote unquote, fought with sticks and stones as the day of the vote approached and the festival was declared, in order to basically the Senate declared a festival. And so they weren't there. So they were away on holiday when the vote was come in. Sulpicius actually ordered his faction to come to the forum with concealed daggers and to do whatever might be required, sparing not even the consuls if necessary. Sulpicius then declared the vacation illegal and ordered the consuls, Sulla and Quintus Pompeius,
Which was this was in 88 BC.
Right. To put an end to all the festivals and ordered the enactment of the laws.
And Sulla used the popular obstruction. He retaliated by using the popular obstruction of observing the heavens for auspicious omens, which would have nullified all legislation on the spot. And like you said, Silippius responds with the brand new tactic of violence in the forum.
Exactly. And, you know, so you have, yeah, basically Sulla sees this. He slips out. He's saying...
Well, the tiny bit of evidence here that maybe Marius wasn't quite off his rocker yet was Sulla was forced to flee because of the armed gangs and the armed Silippius Tribune. He was forced to flee for his life. Even though he had troops stationed in... where was that? Even though he had a troop stationed ready to go to the east, he was forced to flee with his life and was forced to take... shelter in the house of Marius, of all people. Mm-hmm. Apparently, Marius agrees to give him asylum if Sulla agrees to lay down his command. And Sulla does agree. But Sulla isn't a man to give up easily, especially giving up what is rightfully his.
Exactly. And so what do we see right after he leaves Rome? He just immediately heads to Capua.
Nola, right? Or was it?
Yeah, I think his army was at Nola. Or maybe his army was at Capua, and then they met at Nola
They were outside the city because, like we said in the last episode, armed troops were not allowed inside the boundaries, which was a sacred, sacrosanct, religious boundary of Rome. Anyway.
But anyway, yeah. So he proceeds to Asia. And that, when Sulla leaves, Sulpicius basically passes his law and appoints the war against Mithridates as Marius.
Oh, I love this. Before he goes, fight Mithridates, you know, apparently, according to the ancient sources, Sulla appears before his men and the commanders and says, who do you want to lead you in the east? You know, me or this old guy, Marius? You know, of course the soldiers are like, you know, we want you, we want you. And he, you know, he's prepared to march on Rome. Of course the senior officers won't have it, and apparently they are killed by Sulla's soldiers, and Sulla in turn marches on Rome. And this is yet another precedent set. And this is the first time a man loyal to Rome marches on their own city. The first time actually being Coriolanus, who did not succeed. He did stop outside the gates, but Sulla marches on Rome.
Exactly. And, you know, what he does is he takes control. You know, he basically besieges it and then comes in, takes control of the
city. Murders Silippius, first of all.
Yeah, he just hunts him down. Yeah, Sulpicius is just hunted down and killed.
Before Marius is able to gather men.
Right, and he ends up escaping through a series of adventures. Like, you know, it's kind of dubious. I don't know. Well, you know, but basically we have this narrative of him escaping and hiding in, you know, this old blind man's house, and basically he makes his way to Africa. It's kind of bizarre too that we're told, you know, he's basically, when he first is escaping, he's on a ship, and then he jumps overboard, and he's so corpulent, he's so fat, he can't swim, and he has to have slaves like swim him to shore. You know, I mean, this was supposed to be the premier general of Rome.
Well, and at this point, after, I am absolutely on board that there is some kind of mental deterioration, post-traumatic stress, mental breakdown with Marius. I'm not gonna jump too far ahead, but when he does come back, he is absolutely not the same man.
So basically, Sulla shoots out Marius. Marius supposedly goes and sits in the ruins of Carthage and has a personal embodiment of the destruction of Carthage and his own destruction all at once. Whatever, whether that happened or not. Sulla has all of Sulpicius' laws declared invalid and enacts a provision that all laws have to go through the more conservative Comitia Centuriata. That's that committee that you have to own land in order to be on. That's that the old school committee that really is supposed to make all the decisions. and that business that was to be brought before the people had to go through the Senate. No more of this bringing it straight to the popular assembly. And so this really curtailed the power of the tribunes, as the tribunes could only present bills to the plebs. So basically, it made them all go through, basically anything that they would present to the plebs had to go through the Senate, and the plebs anyway didn't have any power, because now the power to even pass laws was with the Comitia Centuriata.
So Sulla comes to Rome, tries to set things right, basically says, all right, you know, this is the way it's going to be. Now I'm going to leave, and I hope that everyone, you know, follows what I decree. Why my back's turned?
Right. Yeah. And it's almost like you know, he knows he shouldn't have marched on Rome. You know, and he knows that he cannot sustain safety inside of Rome without having a continuous military presence. Which even then, you know, a lot of his soldiers they didn't feel comfortable marching on Rome either. So he was in a very, very sticky situation. So
we're going to constantly see that, you know, glory and loot aside, you know, countrymen don't like fighting countrymen, you know,
and for good reason, because Rome was the most efficient fighting force the world had ever seen. so there's, yeah, I don't know how much of it was patriotic and how much of it was just, you know, you don't want to have to go up against people that know all your tricks, you know.
So in 87 BC, we find Lucius Cornelius Cinna. I like this guy. Lucius Cornelius Cinna as consul. He immediately recalls Marius and reenacts
Sulpicius.
He immediately reenacts Sulpicius' laws that Sulla had just canceled and then marched off to Asia. His co-consul, Octavius, Cinna's co-consul, got as many tribunes as he could to veto Cinna's laws and to drive them out.
Exactly, and it was kind of interesting because Sulla was actually present for these consular elections. He actually put up his own nephew, and his nephew failed. But
you're kidding me.
No, he didn't want to kind of overstep his toes, you know, overstep people's toes. So he basically took Octavius and Cinna aside and made them swear to him that they wouldn't, you know, interfere with the arrangements that he made.
That explains why these consular colleagues were on the complete opposite sides of the fence, and I was wondering about that.
Yeah, and so you also have you know, Sulla, he also carried out an emergency measure to relieve all debts, because as we discussed before, there was huge fighting in the streets, you know, between creditors and debitors. People were just being murdered outright, and no one was seeing anything. So basically, Sulla carries an emergency measure to relieve all debts, which we'll see repeatedly as we go forward. So basically, so he really doesn't trust Cinna, but he ends up leaving because he knows that things are going to get hot.
So as soon as he leaves, Cinna calls on Marius, Sulla's archenemy. And, you know, though Marius is old and probably out of his mind, as long as he can be propped on a horse, he's probably a force to be reckoned
with. Supposedly, his troops bring him back from Africa. You know, he's down there. Some of his troops that were left behind in Africa rally him, and then, you know, end up bringing him back.
And of course, he would have had a lot of troops settled in Africa from his African campaign.
Yeah, granted. And then, you know, basically, he comes back, and it's kind of interesting to see different people's sides on this too. You know, you have, basically Sertorius, which we'll get into. He ends up falling in with, he was an extremely good general, and he doesn't want Marius to be around. He says Marius is too, out of control. You know, Sertorius served under Mara in, he's basically a secret agent during the Cimbrian-Teuton Wars, and he would dress up in, you know, the Celto-Iberian clothes. He learned the language and would go and mingle amongst the troops and report back to Marius.
Wow.
Yeah, so basically he ends up joining with Cinna, and he ends up writing to Cinna, you know, I don't want Marius here. He's too wild. He's too passionate. He says his passions get the best of him, and it's really an interesting dialogue, you know, that they have. But
and Senna also anyway. Tried to enlist these newly enfranchised Italians, and poor Octavius, with Sulla gone now, he really had little to turn to.
Right, and really when Sulla was leaving too, he was really eyeballing Strabo, who was just sitting back watching this whole mess take place. You know, he even sends...
Strabo clearly becomes the wild card here.
Right, and he actually orders, Sulla orders before he leaves Strabo to return... To return to Rome without his troops, but
forgot about that.
Strabo ends up putting up the tribune Herennius to veto the measure. So Strabo's commanding a little bit of political clout enough to respond to the man that marched on Rome.
And doesn't the agent who is sent by, is it Senna or Sulla, to displace Strabo ends up
right?
Ends up being killed. Supposedly Strabo wasn't involved.
Right, because Sulla, when the votes veto, Sulla then orders a transfer of his command from Strabo to his cousin, the Pompeius Rufius, who was basically a colleague of Sulla. You know, so Strabo had his troops under basically they welcomed Rufus to his camp, and then the next day, as Rufus was about to conduct a sacrifice, we're told. Strabo kind of withdraws from the scene, basically to demonstrate a lack of official standing in the matter, whereupon his men kind of surround Rufius, his own cousin, and murder him. So, obviously, the lineage that Pompey the Great comes from is not that close with the rest of his clan, if they're willing to murder his own cousin. So
Strabo was propositioned from both sides, because he was in a position to change the tide of war. Mm-hmm. He does join the senatorial party, but before we ask why, there is a little story that Senna had gotten tired of waiting after sending repeated overtures to Strabo, that Senna had grown tired of waiting and conspired to have Pompey and his son, our Pompey the Great, murdered. Apparently the young Pompey was informed while in camp with his father, and apparently he ate and drank at dinner normally that night. He got the rumor that he was supposed to be murdered in his tent at night, and then his father would follow probably in a similar fashion, and Pompey cleverly had stuffed his bed. This is Pompey the Younger, Pompey the Great, had stuffed his bed sheets with
right, because Pompey at this time, he had been with his father all throughout the social wars. You know, he had been through basically with his father this entire time. And, you know, basically during this consulship of Senna and Octavius, you know, they start clashing over the Italian tribes again. You know, and basically violence over the issue drove Senna from the city. Senna actually had a small force amassed at Nola and began raising more and more Italians. Marius returned from Africa and landed in Etruria. So you basically had Senna to the south and Marius to the north. Rome started threatening both from the north and south. Or Rome was threatened from both from the north and south, and they called on Strabo, who was still in command of Picenum. And they started levying troops from Transpadine Gaul. However, these forces were intercepted by the Senna's forces, but Strabo was delayed and really slow to respond to the Senate's request for help, you know, which is kind of suspicious. Mm-hmm. So he was letting them, Marius and Senna, get worked up, and basically under Octavius's weak protection and basically Strabo's delaying, Marius came in, started to attack from the north.
And absolutely, to his discredit maybe, Strabo's delay allowed the Marian army to grow.
It's kind of interesting. I wonder how much of that was him wanting to wait for the situation to get so critical that they turned to him and would elect him consul. You know, I really think maybe Strabo was was gunning
for a second consulship
here.
Well, there has to be a reason why he was not picking a side right away. And it seems that, you know, other than the fact that Cinna tried to have him and his son murdered, because this conspiracy, before it was discovered, you know, it happened. In retaliation to something Strabo must have done. And the story goes that Pompey did uncover the conspiracy. And as good of a general as Strabo was, he wasn't apparently a very nice guy. Apparently he was pretty greedy. So sometimes his popularity with his troops waned in and out. And they were kind of up for the idea of overthrowing him. And apparently the young Pompey cried and begged the troops to not abandon his father. And he lay down in front of the gates of the camp and he said that, you know, if you want to leave my father, you're going to have to trample me to death. You know, you're going to have to walk out over me. And Pompey was always very loved. The younger Pompey was much loved by the troops. And apparently his emotions and his pleading was able to drive them back to loyalty. For whatever reason that Strabo did not join Cinna, his delays allowed the Marian army to grow, as I said. It was so large that Marius was able to take one army, Sertorius another, and Cinna the third.
Right, and we also have Carbo. So basically under Marius you had Sertorius and Carbo, and then he led another one. And he ended up taking the Janiculum, which is kind of where they do their religious, where Rome did their religious ceremonies. And then he ends up taking Ostia, which is that major corn port that we realize. So he ends up taking that, and only when...
Right down the... And you can access Ostia, of course, the port of Ostia.
Right.
Right down the Tiber and right to Rome.
Right, and that was the major corn. So that was a major strategic location, which, you know, was a huge thing. And it was only then... it was only when he took Ostium, which Marius pitched a camp right outside the Colline Gates, which is really interesting. You know, why wouldn't he protect that major port? You know, we don't know. But basically, Strabo then fought against Sertorius and then detached some 6 cohorts to assist Octavius. He also went to assist Octavius himself. And so he basically drove Marius from the Janiculum. You know, Pompey was probably right by his side this entire time, we have to imagine. And it was probably at this time when that plot to kill him was hatched.
And in this battle, doesn't Octavian almost lose his life?
Right, and it's kind of weird because Strabo, you know, Octavius starts making some ground, but Strabo really starts preventing him from following up on his success and starts prolonging the war with his,
sympathizers inside the city are convinced to open the gate.
Yeah, and you know, it's really, yeah, basically what Strabo does is he starts preventing prosecution. He's really trying to secure a second consulship here, and he's trying to prevent prosecution and supersession by Metellius Pius. You know, this was the son of Metellus Numidicus, the former commander and the Jugurthine Wars. So he's trying to prevent that from happening because he really wants that position. So now he convinces the Senate to give a hearing to Cinna's envoys while secretly back-channeling with Cinna. And this is when Strabo apparently dies.
Well, he does arrive in time to save Octavian. Well, initially, he does save the day. Unfortunately, this is his last battle because he's struck by lightning.
Yeah, so he's basically in the middle of negotiating. You know, he has this, you know, he helps Octavius, but then he starts, you know, not helping him. And then he starts back channeling with Cinna, and he basically has the Senate hear out Cinna's envoys. And while he's kind of playing the both the sides, he's supposedly struck by lightning or
there's also
dies by the plague.
Which I think we get from Appian that there was a plague which took a lot of lives, which is probably what happened. But as I mentioned with Strabo...
I don't know. This seems way too peculiar of a circumstance. Right here at when the enemies are at the gates...
It's a powerful omen.
He's back channeling with the enemy. negotiating a hostile takeover of Rome, basically.
He plays that game so well.
And he's basically, and you know, Pompey's right there. He's learning all of these tactics. He's learning everything, all the political maneuvering that Strabo's doing. And basically Strabo is killed. And we're told that even at his funeral, you know, he is so hated by the troops and the mob for his delaying and his just greediness and abrasiveness, that he's literally pulled from his funeral procession and dragged through the mud on a hook.
Must have been awful for the young Pompey.
Pompey must have been there.
And we have Plutarch. I should probably say that Plutarch was a Greek historian who, born, I think, in about 46 AD, wrote during the reign of Trajan and Hadrian. We use some of the sources here. He's not necessarily... He equates more to the modern biographer and less a true historian. And he kind of lacks the passion of Herodotus, I think. But he focuses more on the characters, the events in history that cause these famous people to behave a particular way. And he writes these series of stories, many of which survive on the lives of famous Romans and Greeks. Anyway, he says of Strabo in his narrative after his death, "I hate the father, but I love this son of his. For the Romans never hated any of their generals so much and so bitterly as they hated Pompey's father, Strabo. While he was alive, they stood in awe of his military power, and he was certainly a most formidable soldier. But when he was killed by a thunderbolt, they insulted his body and dragged it from the pyre as it was being carried to the funeral. On the other hand, no Roman was ever held in such affection by the people as Pompey the Younger was, and no Roman enjoyed an affection which started so early in his career, which reached such a height in his prosperity, and which remained so constant in his time of adversary." So.
Yeah, and so with the death of Strabo, you have Rome being seized by Marius and Cinna, and they come in. Marius had actually enlisted a number of slaves at this point, and they end up starting a series of murders. They murder the orator M. Antonius. They murder Catulus. They murder Octavius. They end up...
This M. Antonius, a real interesting character, but I'll just say briefly, not the character who's been come down to history as Mark Antony, the lover of the Egyptian queen, Cleopatra XII, the famous Cleopatra, Mark Antony. This would be his great-grandfather, who was also one of the leading, unfortunately, was one of the leading orators in Rome and mentor of Marcus Tullius Cicero, who's going to play a pivotal role in our narrative.
And I believe he was the first to prosecute a war against the pirates in the Mediterranean.
Which he, and that's another good piece of evidence. He did not succeed in eliminating the pirate threat in the Mediterranean, which eventually is going to almost stop importing goods and trade. And, you know, the most powerful empire in the world, the pirates become such a menace in the seas that they almost shut down trade in Italy. He did not succeed, as far as I understand.
And basically at this point, Marius was so demented, he basically was having his slave thugs, which were told by Plutarch and numbered about 4,000. He basically would motion by hand and his enemies would be struck down in front of him. And Cinna ended up, he ended up doing a little bit of this murdering initially in Rome, but really Marius, we're told, takes it to a level where even Cinna was disgusted by it. And really Sertorius, who was basically serving underneath Marius before, has to come in and murder Marius's troops. And then he reprimands Marius, and then he even reprimands Cinna at the same time. So Sertorius starts to become really disgusted by what happens. He didn't even want Marius in on this, but Cinna invited him, supposedly, and which kind of puts doubts on whether he was actually to me, whether he was in Africa and his troops got him, because we read in Plutarch that Sertorius says, I didn't want him, but now that you've invited him, we can't tell him, you know, not to be part of this. So by all means, we'll include Marius.
I'm so compelled by Sertorius's opinion on these matters. I mean, we'll explore him in the next episode, but he's such a formidable soldier and a warrior. I mean, he's just unbelievable. He's just unbelievably brilliant that it's hard to, you know, it's hard not to take him seriously when he has, if he has reservations about Marius, it's a little hard not to take him seriously.
Yeah, he's a really interesting figure, you know, and I think we'll talk more about him as we go on, because obviously he becomes one of the pivotal enemies of Pompey in Spain. At least in Pompey's early life, he becomes a pivotal enemy for him. So, after
Strabo dies, the resistance basically collapses.
Marius and Cinna install themselves and they're basically declared consuls in 86.
And Octavius does stand his ground, and he loses his head for the trouble.
Right. And basically Sulla is then formally exiled and all of his laws are repealed. Marius, we're told, obtains his seventh consulship and then dies a few days later. He's fulfilled the prophecy of the soothsayer in Africa.
But that is not before Marius becomes severely unhinged. And for not the first time, but one of the first extreme time, the bloodbath. That's what I have in my notes, bloodbath. Yeah, yeah. Marius enacts his revenge on everyone who did not support him.
Right.
Almost indiscriminately.
It basically takes Sertorius coming in and
I mean, there is
wiping out his slave. He basically takes 400 slaves, gives them freedom and weapons, brings them into Rome, and they just rape and murder at will. To have been there when, you know, 4,000 rapists and murderers were descending upon the town would have been the most terrifying. You know, we're told that
this is probably as bad as it's ever been since the Gauls invaded Rome, 300 years ago, almost more than 300 years ago. Just, yes, an indiscriminate massacre inside the gates of Rome.
And we're told that he's really starting to, have a lot of dementia. He believes he's already in campaign against Mithridates, and he's starting to organize his troops, or his slave, his 4,000 slaves. You know, he's starting to organize, and he's acting like he's on the battlefield fighting Mithridates, and you know, it's just a really bizarre situation, and he dies, which, you know. It leads me to believe that maybe Cinna, just maybe, had, you know, in some of these forces had actually resurrected Marius as more of a political figurehead, and he was involved mainly for his name and his reputation and nothing more.
It's like what I said in the first episode, the betrayals, the conspiracies, the political maneuvering. There is so much that's just shrouded by the eons of time that passed that we won't understand, in questions that we can't answer, you know, in the next couple paragraphs here. You know, Pompey is recorded as trying to or successfully joining Cinna's army for a while. Like,
yeah. Yeah. And it's kind of interesting, you know, in the next 3 years, you know, he basically appoints, Cinna basically has the consulship. And he appoints Flaccus as his fellow consul, and then he ends up appointing
Carbo
after him. And basically, there's administering a somewhat normal Rome for what's going on. Flaccus carries a major which cancels 3/4 of all the outstanding debts. Again, you know, this is kind of a reoccurring theme because everyone's having to use so much money to bribe everyone. So there's this continuous debt. So, and really when they cancel debt, it's just reshuffling the money around. You know, basically people are writing off one book, putting on another book. It's just placating this oppressed oppressed political classes.
And here is the true rise of Pompey the Great. But I want to close the chapter really quick with poor Marius again. I really like that guy.
We just got done talking about how he murdered wantonly.
He horribly ended his career. You know, I like in this podcast to kind of talk about the what ifs, and I'm not going to overdo it. But you know, here's a man who rose from relatively humble origins. I'm sure he was much better off than the vast majority of citizens in the world. You know, but he was elected consul legitimately 6 times, had a brilliant, brilliant military career, and would have been remembered, is remembered forever, but he just is never going to be able to be remembered as anything but just a bloodstained tyrant for what he did when he came back from Africa.
It's really interesting because...
No one could sympathize with him after...
He was viewed as such a hero, and then he turns into such a villain.
How popularity can give somebody... He was such a popular general that he was elected, like you said, 6 consecutive years. And I see that mirrored in Pompey a little bit. His popularity is so strong because of his military exploits.
And I think, too, it also shows that Rome is getting involved in wars that really take more than just a single year to execute. You cannot execute a prolonged war against a large number of people in a single season, basically. And so in order to take care of the Teuton and Cimbri, he had to be elected, multiple years in a row. And this is a theme that we'll see reoccurring quite frequently.
So around this time, the young Pompey is put on trial for some reason, for the wartime theft of petty items like books and hunting nets that his father supposedly illegally procured
during the social war.
The siege of Osculum. Ironically, Carbo is here defending him on trial, and we're probably going to do a little bit on with the jury courts. Modern historians, we don't exactly know how the court systems worked 100%. But another interesting character who is going to minorly be playing a part in our story was Quintus Hortensius, who also defends Pompey in court. He becomes a pretty staunch conservative and generally is not a Pompeian throughout his life. So that's another...
Hortensius is actually one of the premier... he's actually the premier orator in Rome.
Oh, yes.
At the time, before Cicero comes in, which is it's really interesting, and I think having him at this, I think all the different characters at Pompey's prosecution, because this is really the first time we have anything of any kind of substance other than this weird assassination attempt. This is the first time we really dig into something with any kind of structure that we can hang on Pompey.
And do you think that this is, there's people massacring people in the streets. So do you think this is kind of a petty, I can't really explain this prosecution, but I think we can safely say that he was not seen as a force to be reckoned with, despite who his father was. And he would have been, 18, maybe 19? Plutarch does say this, Pompey is acquitted of the charges. Our first description of Pompey in Plutarch's narrative is as follows. At the beginning of his career, too, he had an appearance which seemed to plead for him before he opened his mouth, and this was a great help to him in winning people's affection. He was attractive, certainly, but part of his attractiveness lay in a kind of dignity, sweet and sweetness of disposition, and at the height and flower of his youthful beauty, there was apparent at the same time the majesty, the kingliness of his nature. His hair swept back in a kind of wave from his forehead, and the configuration of his face round the eyes gave him a melting look, so that he was supposed, though the resemblance was not a close one, to resemble the statues of King Alexander. It was the name often given to him in his early youth, and Pompey himself was not averse from it, so that people soon applied the word Alexander to him in mockery. It was because of this, too, that Lucius Philippus, a man of consular rank, when speaking for Pompey in the courts, said that there was nothing strange in the fact that he, being Philip, should love Alexander.
Right, and we have such a comparison made to him as being Alexander the Great. It's almost, a lot of these stories are almost too much too weird to believe, because like we have Marcius Philippus Hortensius, we have Carbo there defending Carbo, who was one of the who was basically the consul along with Cinna, is basically there. You know, and Cinna was really the guy that brought this action against him. You know, so it's really strange how we see this dynamic. You know, we have Sertorius kind of dissenting with Cinna and the way he does things. You can really see how this force is really not a unified force. These quote unquote Marian forces, they're not really a unified force. And even at the end of you know, this court proceeding, he ends up marrying the daughter of the leader of the court,
Antistius.
Antistius. He ends up marrying Antistius's daughter,
Antistia,
and he was acquitted on all charges. And we're told he marches out of the courtroom with a crowd of onlookers singing wedding songs as they marched away into the sunset. And that's basically how that's left, which is sort of dubious. I don't know how many people leave court, you know, marching, you know, to wedding bells when you're brought in there for criminal charges. So,
also Plutarch also says that Pompey impressed everyone with sharpness beyond his years. His good looks and getting married to the judge's daughter probably helped his prospects. And on his character, in contrast to his father Strabo, who, as we've seen, was very widely hated, there are many reasons for loving Pompey, Plutarch writes. His modest way of life, his record as a soldier, his eloquence, his trustworthy character, and the easy, tactful way he had of dealing with people. No one ever asked favors with less offense or granted them with more grace, for among his many charms, he possessed the ability to give without arrogance and to receive without loss of dignity. That's a startling contrast from his father, who is hated, namely, for his insatiable love of money.
Yeah, so cool. So it's yeah, really interesting. You know, and the next time that we see Pompey is in Cinna's camp. And I don't know if you want to go into that now or if you want to do it in the next episode. We can go into...
Let's see here. We have, during these next 3 years, according to Appian, Sulla had defeated Mithridates, and Cinna and Carbo during these 3 years of peace... Oh, I like this. Okay, so in 3 years, Sulla more or less defeats Mithridates. And I think you should elaborate on that a little bit. We're going to see a lot of Mithridates. But the next thing I have in my notes that seems noteworthy is that during the 3 years that Sulla was in Asia, while all his friends were getting massacred in Rome, Cinna and Carbo stupidly did next to nothing to raise a strong enough army to receive him when he returns.
Yeah, and it's really strange too.
The Senate sent on envoys to Greece offering Sulla peace and security if he will come back to Rome and be peaceful. And apparently, according to Appian, I believe, he replies with a chilling response: "As for security, it seems I'm in a better position to offer it than you."
Right.
We're drawing a lot of these sources from. Let's see here, Appian. I have something in here. Appian was a Greek Alexandrian, born, we think, 95 AD. Wrote between 145 and 146. And he mostly writes his narrative, the relationship of the Romans to various actions, broken up accordingly. He's a fun historian. You know, the standards then are a little different than they are today. I'm not going to elaborate on that, but... He's got his book, The Civil Wars, is a real fun.
It's a staple.
It's a staple. Yeah. It's good literature. So, sorry, Luke, what were you
saying? So yeah, basically, Sulla's over there fighting Mithridates. They end up having a series of engagements, and I think we might get into more of what's going on with Mithridates, because this becomes a major figure in Pompey's later life. But basically, he's over there. They sent.
Did we mention that Athens had gone over to the quote-unquote liberator of Roman oppression, Mithridates, and at the start of the war, Mithridates, you know, mercilessly slaughtered some 80,000 Roman men, women, and children.
Exactly. Yeah, and you know, so it's really, you know, there's a huge amount of backstory, you know, you see Mithridates kind of pop up his face into, like, you know, various battle campaigns and such, you know, sure, supporting different sides.
And if Pompey's the Roman Alexander, I love that, then Mithridates is clearly the Greco-Persian Alexander.
Yes, the Pontic Alexander.
The Pontic Alexander.
Yeah, so, I mean, you basically have... they also send Senescens, Flaccus, his old colleague, Flaccus, and kind of a backup hitman-type character, Fimbria, out there. And they basically go straight for Mithridates, bypassing... Basically, Sulla has the war wrapped up. He is negotiating... with one of the generals of the army in Boeotia over near Athens, and basically they go and start up more fighting with Mithridates, and basically there's a lot of ins and outs, but Sulla basically ends up writing the Senate, and here's what Appian says about that. Sulla wrote the Senate in a tone of superiority, recounting what he had done in Africa in the war against Jugurtha, the Numidian, while still quaestor, as lieutenant in the Cimbric War, as praetor in the Cilicia, and in the Social War, and as consul. Most of all, he dwelt upon his recent victories in the Mithridatic War, enumerating to them the many nations which had been under Mithridates and which he had recovered before the Romans. Of nothing did he make more of an account than that those who had been banished from Rome by Cinna had fled to him, and that he had received them in their helplessness and supported them in their affliction. In return for this, he said, he had been declared a public enemy by his foes. His house had been destroyed, his friends put to death, and his wife and children had with difficulty made their escape to him. He would be there presently to take vengeance on behalf of themselves and of the entire city upon the guilty ones. He assured the other citizens, the new citizens, that he would make no complaint against them. And so that's the tone of what he writes to the Senate. And when they receive, when the Senate receives this letter, we're told by Appian, when the letters were read, fear fell upon all, and they began sending messengers to reconcile him with his enemies and to tell him in advance that if he wanted any security, he should write to the Senate at once. They ordered Cinna and Carbo to cease recruiting soldiers until Saul's answer should be received. They promised to do so, but as soon as the messengers had gone, they proclaimed themselves consuls for the ensuing year, and so that they need not come back to the city earlier than told the elections. They traversed Italy, collecting soldiers, whom they carried across by detachments on shipbirds to Liburnia, which was to act as their base against Sulla. So basically, Sulla writes to the Senate, and they start crapping their pants and trying to rally up as many troops as possible.
I like the way you said it better. So the consuls finally start to perceive the enormous, enormous threat of a man who just conquered Mithridates. Well,
it's almost as if they didn't realize he was out there until he writes them, and you know, it's baffling.
But, and Sulla, well, to put it briefly, he ends up making a peace treaty, and charging Mithridates with an indemnity to Rome, where he has to pay some tribute. He lets him keep his ancestral kingdom, which is very nice considering all the trouble Mithridates caused. But he was, in my opinion, up against a pretty serious foe. Mithridates had huge amount of resources, always had money, always had allies, and the fact that 80,000 Romans, more or less, were murdered pretty much overnight, and
all in unison,
and a continent-wide conspiracy without the Romans finding out about it, is absolute testament to Mithridates' brilliant ability to
his organizational skills. He was a foe to be reckoned with, and
expect him to be played down by Roman writers. For those of you who want to read in the more details, especially in Appian Civil War, he's played down pretty terribly by Roman writers. But anyway,
basically, Sulla writes this letter. Cinna starts gathering up as many forces. Carbo does too, and Cinna starts bringing them to Ancona in Italy, on the coast of the Adriatic.
Ah.
And he starts amassing them and shipping them over to Greece.
And Senna's going to meet. And Senna's going to meet Sulla in Asia.
And destroy them. And what we're told is he sends one shipment of people over, and then the next shipment goes. And this is kind of interesting because we get two different stories, one from Plutarch, one from Appian.
Do you want to tell?
Yeah. Well, I think it's really interesting because one of them has Pompey in it, one of them doesn't. So basically, in 84, in Cinna's camp, we hear, let's start with the one with Pompey in it. I believe it's Plutarch writes, he then betook himself to Cinna's camp, but because of some a calamitous accusation grew fearful and quickly withdrew unnoticed. On his disappearance, there went a rumor through the camp which said that Cinna had slain the young man, and in consequence of those who had long hated Cinna and felt oppressed by him, made an onslaught upon him. Cinna, as he fled, having been seized by one of the centurions who pursued him with a drawn sword, clasped him by the knees and held out his seal ring, which was of great price. But the centurion, with great insolence, said, "Indeed, I am not come to seal a surety, but to punish a lawless and wicked tyrant," and slew him.
Ah, I think that's a pun, because you seal documents with your signet ring. Oh.
Exactly. So we have Pompey here. It's really a weird set of circumstances, because why would Pompey be in Cinna's camp? And why would his troops care if Pompey was slain? You know, it really doesn't make a lot of sense why it would be the way it is. Because at this point, Pompey is really just almost a non-entity. But to have him appear, and then why would Cinna want to slay him? Why would why would this happen?
Well, and also, Strabo was no friend of Sulla's. So that's a little weird that Pompey inevitably joins him, but it's also even more confusing that Pompey tries to join Cinna. There's like two recorded conspiracies that might just be the same one against him, and then he tries to join Carbo also later, if I'm not mistaken here.
Right, and it's really interesting. We have, in Appian, this the death of Cinna is portrayed in a different way. You know, we're told that Cinna attempts to cross with a second wave of troops. There's a big storm, and they're turned back. And some of the troops lose interest, and they end up scattering about. And he ends up attempting to lecture them. You know, why they're deserting at Rome's, you know, during Rome's need. And one of his lictors ends up being struck by someone in the crowd, and he orders an arrest. And basically, he's stabbed to death by some soldiers, which really is kind of interesting. And not much is made about these two differences in a lot of the biographies that we have. But if we look at, you know, his, both of these things, we have this lictor who's trying to clear this road for Cinna, strike somebody in the way, and then one of the soldiers strike.
And I gotta say, the lictors, the high offices, the high magistrates of office in Rome were preceded by lictors, which were basically paid servants that would carry a bundle of rods and sticks called fasces, which are supposed to symbolize, what is it, the power over life or death, which were old kingly symbols that were a throwback to the old seven kings of Rome. So they're more or less state bodyguards to Rome, for those of you who aren't quite sure what lictors are. Consuls carried 12, there were two consuls elected every year, and they would alternate month by month who was senior consul, and in succession, they would each have the 12 lictors, follow them around.
I think if we look at both of these two accounts of Cinna's death, you know, could it have been that Pompey was there plotting against Cinna at that time? Maybe trying to endear himself to Carbo. Maybe there's a plot between Carbo, because we do know Carbo supported him in the court in the earlier documents. So perhaps he was trying to, play sides here, and perhaps he, was this soldier that was struck by a lictor. I don't know. I think that's a stretch, but who knows? You know, speculation. We could speculate all we want.
Well, Pompey does soon after try to join, or allegedly tries to join Carbo's camp. Some sources say that he successfully does. Don't quote me directly on that. But accusations start to surface about him again, and another possible conspiracy is unveiled for Pompey's life, and he flees to Picenum. And doesn't join Carbo. The only reason I can think why Strabo, first of all, was biding his time holding off second consulship, why does Pompey keep coming back and maybe keep trying to join the either Carbo or Cinna? I'm kind of going with that he probably sought the legitimacy of office, of career advancement. As incompetent as Carbo and Cinna may have been, they did represent a legitimate government, which was something. Also, Sulla was in Asia, and Pompey didn't necessarily know if he was alive, dead, or what condition he would be in if and when he did return to Italy to confront the opposition that would inevitably be awaiting him.
Right, and so with the death of Cinna, Carbo basically took sole control of the government. He was the sole consul. He ended up thwarting an election of a colleague, and basically he tries to bring up as much resistance inside of Italy. He doesn't decide to go meet Sulla in Greece. He ends up taking a proconsular position in 83.
After what happens to Cinna, he decides to test his luck in Italy. Yeah.
And so the consul Scipio and Norbanus are basically advanced, installed as consuls, and we have Sulla sailing from Patrae to Brundisium in Calabria with 40,000 troops that he amasses, and the civil war begins.
And with the supposed conspiracy against Pompey's life from Carbo's faction, as I mentioned, Pompey flees to his homeland of Picenum, and on the next podcast, we'll pick up with what the 23-year-old Pompey does next. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Alan Keith.
And I'm Luke Murphy.
Thanks a lot. Oh, yes. And remember, listeners, you can visit our website at lifeofpompey.wordpress.com. There you will find interesting articles and, of course, a list of all the podcasts we've recorded so far. And you can comment, like, and share our amazing podcast with all your beautiful friends via Facebook, Twitter, that sort of thing. Subscribe to us through iTunes, Podomatic, and we have a Feedburner account now. How about that? So you can fill out all that necessary mumbo, and our podcast will be magically whisked to whatever podcast catch you decide. Thanks again, listeners.